Chair.
The third case on the court's calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Johannes. Judge Bentley is unable to be present, but will listen to the oral argument and participate in the case and the court's deliberation of the issues presented this morning. With that, we're ready to proceed with argument from counsel for appellant. Please identify yourself for the record before you beginning your argument once you've had an opportunity to get the podium adjusted to your liking.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Greg Scanlon, and I represent appellant Timothy Johannes in this consolidated appeal. We are asking the court to remand both cases to Stearns County District Court for resentencing. Respondent's position is that the phrase prior impaired driving conviction in 169A.03 establishes that the word convicted by itself incorporates juvenile adjudications. If respondent is correct, the word convicted encompasses juvenile adjudications anywhere it is used in 169A, and convicted is used in many other places. It is used in sections establishing mandatory jail terms in local correctional facilities. It is used in a section requiring vehicle forfeiture, establishing intensive probation programs in criminal court, and permitting punitive damages in a civil suit when DWI results in an accident. These all sound like circumstances that would not apply to juveniles, but that question is answered by section 169A.54. That section establishes license revocations of various lengths, and it uses the word convicted. In 169A.54, and only in 169A.54, the legislature expressly stated that the provisions of that section encompass juvenile adjudications. Juvenile adjudications apply despite using the word convicted by itself. If respondent is correct about their interpretation here, there would have been no reason to do that in section 169.54. And this is just another example of if they're right, then there's language that serves no purpose in the DWI statute.
Counsel, but before we get to that issue, which is an important one, am I understanding the procedural posture correctly? You convinced one district court to grant post-conviction relief.
Correct.
The second did not.
Correct.
Do we have to say that the second district court, I think it was Stearns County, erred in denying post-conviction relief before we get to the issue of whether or not this juvenile offense is properly accounted? Because I understand it, and I could be wrong. Given the ruling from Stearns Court, your client has the necessary felony DWI conviction because the court wasn't willing to alter that. So we would have to say that decision was wrong. It was not a conviction, therefore this should not have been a felony level sentence. Is that right?
Well, so the court is correct that it's a complicated situation. So we're challenging the 2014, which was a plea, a DWI felony DWI sentence that was imposed after a plea. We're also challenging the 2023 DWI conviction after a trial. And the trial case from 2023 is a little complicated by the fact that
Is that the Stearns County case?
That Stearns County. The 2014 and 2023 Stearns are the two Stearns County. Aitken is in the middle, and Aitken is the one where they ruled in my favor in district court, but that essentially is stayed. They did issue an amended sentencing order changing the Aitken sentence to a gross misdemeanor, but that is stayed pending resolution on the merits,
okay,
assuming that there is resolution on the merits from in a final decision by the Court of Appeals.
And what happened with the 2023 case?
In both cases, the district court denied relief. In the 2013 case specifically, they said that they deemed it to be a post-conviction petition, and it was time-barred.
Okay.
They did not address the interests of justice, which I raised.
Okay.
I, of course, argue that it wasn't a post-conviction petition.
So My question is, do we need to tackle that issue first? Because only if you would prevail in that case do you get to the second issue.
I don't think so.
If we were to say, okay, we're affirming the decision that this was, I'm just hypothetically, a post-conviction relief, it was untimely, there's no interest of justice exception under Sanchez, therefore he has a felony conviction. And he only needs one felony conviction to make this most recent one a felony DWI. What I'm struggling with is, how do we give you relief based on the argument that a juvenile adjudication is not a conviction, given the way it was charged? Because as I understand it, there's three subparts of the statute, and if he were charged under the third subpart, you could look at the juvenile adjudication if it was third and 10, but we're not doing that. We're just talking about one necessary prior, and it has to be a felony. So it seems to me you first have to win on the argument that the post-conviction court erred in refusing to set aside his felony conviction for this prior 2023 DWI.
And here's why I think that's not the case.
Okay.
I think in the tried case, the 2023 case, the court has to reach the merits. And for that, I rely on State versus Outlaw. In State v. Outlaw, that was a case where it was a jury trial. The state filed a Blakely notice, and so they put in a bunch of, submitted to the jury in the Blakely proceeding, a number of, I think, 11 different felony convictions that they said satisfied the five prior felony career offender statute. And defendant didn't object at the trial. The five convictions went in, and he got the upward departure sentence. The Court of Appeals found it necessary to review those 11 felony convictions and make sure they were all felonies. And in fact, they found that seven of them weren't, and so they hadn't satisfied the five. What the Court of Appeals did was, because defendant hadn't objected to those were felonies in district court, they remanded.
Okay.
In the absence of an objection, you remand and you give the state an opportunity to prove that there was a felony conviction.
And I misspoke when I've been saying the 2023 Stearns case. I'm talking about the 2014 Stearns DWI is the one where you have had an opportunity to object. This appeal was stayed so you could pursue post-conviction review. You went to the post-conviction court in Stearns County and said, you should give my client relief from this 2014 case because it shouldn't have been a felony. He didn't have the necessary underlying conviction. And relief was denied. So there has been an opportunity to litigate that, and now we have to review the outcome of that decision. And if we review the outcome of that decision and say the decision is sound, it was time-barred, there was no good faith exception, even though it didn't go to the merits, I don't know how you prevail on your second argument. Or are you saying that we should just open the door to everything in the past and review everything?
Well, I certainly think the 2014 case should be reviewed. But I also think that...
Can we review it if the post-conviction court correctly held it's beyond review at this point? It's time-barred. It's too late to challenge this.
Well, and so I'll get to that in 1 second. I think in order to decide whether the 2023 conviction can stand, I think the court has to address the merits. And has to address the merits meaning you have to look at all three of the convictions. You're doing that without, I mean, if you uphold the post-conviction denial, you're doing that without overturning or without remanding to change the 2014 sentence.
Right.
But in order to figure out whether he really should get a felony conviction in 2023, this court has to decide whether or not the 2014 was a felony. Again, regardless of whether. It's just like in Outlaw.
Why did we stay this for post-conviction proceedings then? If what you're saying is we were going to decide all of this first instance, why did we stay this so we could have this litigated in the post-conviction court? Because it sounds like what you're saying now is, well, we don't like the decision from the post-conviction court, so you should just ignore that and decide whether that really was a felony.
I disagree with the post-conviction court. I do think it was a motion to correct sentence. I think that Coles is wholly inapplicable, because the state bargained for nothing in the 2014 case.
Because it was a trial.
Yes. But okay. Again, there's a difference between figuring out whether a prior felony is a felony for the purpose of sentencing the 2023 case. There's a difference between that and amending the 2014 sentence. In Outlaw, when the
court... Why isn't the fact that he pled guilty to a felony dispositive of that question?
Well, because my position is that it was a mutual mistake, that he pled guilty to a felony because nobody had any idea that it wasn't a felony.
And why didn't he have to challenge that within 2 years? Why isn't that the fact that he's pleading to a felony, why isn't that a merits problem that needs to be argued within 2 years? Right? I mean, because there is a little bit of this case that's like the reason we have the 2-year time bar is so that we're not having to retrace sort of these collateral consequences that can come from prior issues that happened in cases. And part of the 2-year time bar, I think, is so that we're not doing this constant retracing of whether each decision has been proper. And so I guess where I'm struggling is the fact that the felony itself was part of the plea as opposed to it simply being something that occurred at sentencing. Why isn't the district court right that made this a post-conviction petition as opposed to a correction of the sentence?
Well, for one thing, the plea, there wasn't an agreement to a felony sentence. They understood that the presumptive sentence was a felony commit of 42 months to prison. But it's indicated in the record from that case as a straight plea. Mm-hmm. The only thing the state did in response was they did dismiss the other felony DWI charge, because they had to. You can't get convicted of under both theories. And they dismissed the DAR, which the driving after revocation, mm-hmm. which I argued, even if that had stayed, it has no impact in any way on the case. You get the same revocation. It can't be consecutive, meaning that you would get more time with a DAR conviction. And so there's nothing bargained for here. But I guess more to your point about finality, I understand that post-conviction relief is about finality. I also understand that as a court, as a criminal justice system in the state of Minnesota, I think we should be concerned that he's, again, if we reach the merits, and I'm correct on the merits, he spent 42 months in prison that he shouldn't have. And again, he's a 19-year-old when that case happens. It's his first appearance in criminal court, didn't have any prior criminal charges before that. He had stuff in juvenile, but it's his first criminal offense. And he's the amateur in the room, the PSI writer, the person who wrote the complaint, every prosecutor that appeared on the case, every defense attorney who appeared on the case, every judge that touched the case. Maybe this is answers your question, why did I start in post-conviction? I've only done criminal. I've only ever been a criminal defense attorney. And one of the things that you know is that convicted doesn't mean adjudicated. And so the reason I started in post-conviction was naivety. I thought this was an easy question and my client was in prison. And I thought it would be faster there if I was right and he'd get out.
Counsel, I see your argument regarding the post-conviction court's decision in the 2014 case. Your argument is the post-conviction court erred. This was truly a sentence correction. We weren't adjusting the conviction. That, to me, there seems to be tension with you then saying to this court, we have to decide whether or not that 2014 case, whether it was a felony. So, I mean, it seems like you're asking us to decide what type of conviction it was while saying this was just to correct sentence. We're not going to whether this was, we're not challenging the conviction. It seems like you are challenging the conviction. And I appreciate the passionate argument you're making, but we do have timelines that bar, you know, a challenge 10 years later, unless there's interest of justice and you have to show that there's something that prevented your client from raising this issue sooner. And the knower should have known standard is not very forgiving. And I mean, we're just applying the law that's out there.
Right. And again, in Outlaw, when this court remanded to district court and said, prosecutor, here's your chance, find a fifth felony conviction. The Court of Appeals said that these seven things that you submitted as felonies are not felonies.
And why
the
weren't court of they appeals felonies? What type of case was it? Was it a habitual offender? They need to be sentenced in a certain order? Or?
No. It was the five prior felony career offender statute.
It's, and why did we say the things that had been submitted were inadequate?
Because they looked at the record, the existing record,
yes,
of all 11 convictions. And for, I mean, it's remarkable. For those seven, the state hadn't established that those were felony convictions in Minnesota. I think some of them were from other jurisdictions.
Oh, they were out-of-state convictions.
I don't know that all of them were, but I don't remember. But some of them were.
Well, they were out of jurisdiction.
My point is that this court didn't amend those sentences. Those sentences, wherever they're from, are probably still felonies.
Okay, but that,
for
that's
anyone
a whole
else.
Different body of law, because when we have case law that says when you're dealing with out-of-state convictions and somebody comes up and says, hey, you shouldn't have counted this out-of-state conviction as a felony, the state didn't prove it up as they're required to do, and we always say, well, if there wasn't an objection, we're going to reverse and remand to give the state an opportunity to prove that these were felonies. Is that what happened in Outlaw? It was remanded so the state would have an opportunity to prove that out-of-state.
To prove that there were five convictions.
But that's a very different situation than we have here, because that truly is a sentencing case. You're not dealing with potentially time-barred challenges to the conviction itself.
Well, but this court still, as it stands, I mean, in the 2023 trial, the only thing in the record that establishes a felony DWI for that charge is the Aitkin County case, which currently is a gross misdemeanor. There's a sentencing order now that says that's a gross misdemeanor.
Wait, so are you challenging the sufficiency of the evidence for the conviction?
No, because when the trial happened, it was a felony. The problem is now it's a gross misdemeanor.
Okay,
and
but
so,
you're
saying, I mean, maybe.
But I think what you're telling me is the Aitkin prior was the only charge that served as the basis to enhance the 2023 to a felony. Wasn't the 2014 Stearns County DWI?
No, because it was stipulated. In other words, the parties stipulated in the 2023 trial that the charge was a felony because the 2018 Aitkin case was a felony.
Okay.
There's
so
no reference to the Stearns County case.
Understood.
To the 2014 Stearns County case.
Understood. So what you're telling me is that the 2024 or 2014 felony DWI conviction was not a basis for the 2023 conviction.
Correct. Correct. They happened in succession. And that's also why I would argue.
But why are we considering it here?
The 2014?
Yes.
Because my position is it was an illegal sentence. My
right,
position
but what
is
I'm asking is, are you telling me that in order to convict your client of the felony DWI in 2023, the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had a prior felony DWI conviction? There was a stipulation that the Aitkin case was the necessary prior felony DWI conviction, and at no point in trial did the state offer evidence of the 2014 Stearns County felony DWI conviction to prove up its case?
I think that's right.
Okay, so if that wasn't part of the record resulting in this 2023 conviction, why are we concerned with it? That's what I'm struggling with. I mean, if it wasn't the evidence.
Why are we concerned with changing that one, you mean?
Yes. If that isn't even the basis for his conviction.
Well, here's why. Is because if I'm right on the merits and we don't change 2014, that 2014, if it remains a felony, he's felony enhanceable for the rest of his life. As long as that remains a conviction. And that's a potential outcome of this case.
Okay,
the court could reverse.
I don't know that you, let's put it this way. I think if you were to come up to us and say, we want to appeal the 2014 conviction in 2025 because if that was wrongly deemed a felony, it's going to haunt him and have collateral consequences, you couldn't bring that appeal. It's untimely. The only way you could get relief would be to do it through the post-conviction court, which you've done, and you weren't successful, so now we have to review the post-conviction court's decision. I don't see how you can ask us to evaluate the merits of the 2014 conviction in this appeal without regard to the post-conviction court when the 2014 case is long past the point of appeal and it wasn't used as a basis to prove up the felony here. It's not a situation where you're saying he's been convicted of a felony based on this 2014 case and the presumption that it's a felony. We need to make sure it's a felony. That's not what happened here.
Well, but 2023 did rely on the 2018 case, and the 2018 case relied on the 2014 case. And so without the 2014 case, 2018 is not a felony.
But you already have a ruling in your favor there.
Right, on the merits. And so what I'm saying is, but the decision there is that is going to stay in place. The gross misdemeanor sentence will stay in place unless there's a ruling on the merits on the statutory interpretation question that says that judge is wrong. In other words, it's staying a gross misdemeanor forever unless an appellate court says Mr. Johannes is wrong, his 2014 was a felony, his 2018 was a felony. Unless there's a judgment on the merits of the statutory interpretation question, 2018 is going to remain a gross misdemeanor forever. And again, I didn't file a post-conviction motion. It was deemed a post-conviction motion. They're wrong about that. Coles does not say that any time there's a plea agreement, you can't change the sentence. Coles, they did this whole, Coles backed out of his deal. He got this huge downward departure.
But 2014 wasn't even, it was a trial.
No, 2014 was a plea.
2014 was the plea.
2014 was a plea. There were two felony DWI charges and a DAR. The two felony DUIs were just different theories. I think one was refusal and one was under the influence or whatever. He pled to one of those, the other one got dismissed, would have to get dismissed, and the prosecutor also agreed to dismiss the DAR. He's getting a revocation on the DWI anyway. And so, and again, when you look at the record, it just says straight plea, presumptive sentence, 42 months. I think that the defense did argue for a downward dispositional departure, I think, which was denied. But what the state's expectation in the 2014 plea was that Mr. Johannes would go to prison for 42 months. He went to prison for 42 months. They're not losing anything in treating
this. Well, they're losing, as you've said, the felony conviction, which could result in future enhancement.
Which they shouldn't get if I'm right on the merits. I mean, I think we should be concerned about somebody being tagged. And I get that we're not happy with Mr. Johannes' DWI record. I'm not either. He's not either. But we have to look at the procedural and statutory interpretation in this case dispassionately. This is about whether somebody should wrongly be subject to felony enhancement for the rest of their lives based on something that I say is
I don't error. Think they should. But we, as a court of law, are bound by precedent saying, you know, when we can consider a collateral attack on a conviction, and there are certain time bars. So we have to analyze, I think, the post-conviction court's decision. We can't just ignore it and say, well, we're going to take a fresh look at the 2014 case and make sure it was felony conviction.
And I'm saying that the 2014 court was wrong about this being a post-conviction petition.
Understood.
And I still say that however they want to treat it, the sentence is wrong on the merits.
All right.
I'm the only one who's talked about the interest of justice exception. I said in my brief that we probably should remand if we're going to apply the time bar.
How do we apply the interest of justice exception when we have to look at it's something that prevented your client from seeking relief sooner, and it's what he knew or should have known. And like I said, the case law there is very tough. You can't just say, well, he didn't know. His lawyer missed this. He didn't know. I don't think that gets you to application of the interest of justice exception.
Well, in my second reply in Stearns County in the 2014, addressing the 2014 case, well, addressing both of them in the same, I set forth in there, I take four pages, I think, arguing the interest of justice exception. I mean, talk about exceptional or unusual circumstances. I mean, let's say, for the sake of argument, somebody missed it.
I know, but does the case law not say, when applying this interest of justice exception, it's not an injustice resulting from the decision that was made, it's an injustice that prevented you from bringing the challenge in a timely fashion.
And that's precisely my argument. That, again, we're talking about Mr. Johannes. We're not talking about me. We're not talking about his lawyer. We're talking about did he know that he could have raised this and didn't?
But is that the standard under our case law?
I believe it is. Whether the defendant... Because
knew or should have known. It's not whether the defendant knew, and I believe the case law expressly rejects an objective knowledge requirement.
Okay,
it's knew or should have known.
Should have known. And this is why I talk about his age and his lack of experience at the criminal justice system and the fact that everyone missed it. I mean, how's he supposed to know? How would he have known? How would a 19-year-old in his first criminal case, he shows up, he only knows what people tell him, what his lawyer tells him, what the complaint says, what the judge says, what the PSI says, what the prosecutor says. Everybody's saying this is a felony. And you know what he did? He took responsibility, and he accepted the punishment, and he served for the time. And so Understood. He was supposed to realize at some point that was all wrong. I mean, I wish the look on his face when I first talked to him about this was part of the record. I mean, no idea.
Understood. Well,
I have two questions, if you don't mind. My first question is, if he had pled to a gross misdemeanor, would the sentence have been different? The range would have been different, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, the maximum sentence, well, in 2014, it would have been
365. Because you're saying you're not challenging the sentence that he served, but it does seem that there would be a problem with the sentence that he served, potentially, right?
I don't know what you mean.
Are there collateral consequences other than just this? If we say, yes, Aiken was wrong, yes, 2014 Stearns was wrong, yes, Aiken was wrong, are there other consequences other than just this sort of, that he served too much time, that might also come into play in evaluating whether the time bar should apply to something like this?
Yeah, whatever other consequences there were as far as vehicle impoundment or license suspension, all those sorts of things are worse for a felony than they are for a gross misdemeanor. And so, yeah, everything would get reduced in some way. In reality, none of that's going to happen. If he were to be resentenced on the 2014 case to a gross misdemeanor, it might trigger a new driver's license revocation. I doubt that it would trigger a new vehicle impoundment since the vehicle is long gone. But yeah, once that sentence is imposed, there probably are collateral things that would happen. But if anything, they're less than what was imposed, what the collateral consequences were in 2014. And to the extent that they get to do it again because he's resentenced, well, he has to deal with that because he's the one asking for the new sentence.
And then my second question is, did the court in Aiken analyze whether or not this was a motion to correct a sentence or a post-conviction petition, or did the court just say, yes, this is a motion to correct the sentence, or did they not address it?
They did, and they found that, I'm paraphrasing, the difference in the 2018 case is there was also a drug possession charge, a drug possession count, that actually carried a longer sentence. And so even though it was a plea, by vacating that or making a gross misdemeanor, it doesn't change what the state bargained for. They bargained for the sentence on the top count, and they got that sentence, and he served that sentence. And so, yeah, because that one was time-barred too, of course. But the court found that, deemed it a motion to correct sentence. Again,
but that didn't really give him any... Well, it didn't give him any relief on the time he had served. It just takes us off his record as a felony.
Right. I think he had already expired on the large... Well, he might have still had some time left on that larger sentence. But again, the district court in Aiken found that the 2014 Stearns sentence was illegal.
Thank you.
I realize it's a mess, and I've taken way past my time, so I'm going to sit down and give Mr.
Chairman. Thank you. Counsel for the state. Would you begin with your name for the record?
Name is Kyle Triggs, on behalf of the Stearns County Attorney's Office.
Thank you.
Sorry. proceed whenever. May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. On behalf of the state of Minnesota, I am asking this court to affirm the district court's post-conviction decision with respect to the two Stearns County cases. I want to begin by saying this. Over 40 years ago, the legislature wrote a clear message into our DWI laws when it comes to enhancement. They said a prior juvenile adjudication for a qualifying offense is a prior conviction.
Is a prior impaired driving conviction.
In the 40 years ago, they used the term prior conviction, and then in 1989 rephrased it as prior impaired driving conviction.
Which then the statute now in some places says conviction, and in some places says prior impaired driving conviction.
Correct. Well, my point would be this, is when we look at that statute, that provision that they created 40 years ago and how it has continued through time, the whole point of that provision was to address what the word conviction means.
But we don't look back in time when we're doing a plain language analysis.
I would agree.
So, I mean, we can't look at that history unless we agree with you that this statute is ambiguous. And where I struggle with this case is that prior impaired driving conviction is a defined term. That defined term is used throughout the statute. That defined term is not used in the provision of 169A.24 that we're talking about here. And so I struggle to understand the import of that without understanding that there's historical context out there, but in terms of a plain language analysis, I'm struggling to understand the import of that clause.
In response to that, Your Honor, I would say that as we kind of learned from State v. Retzlaff, when we look at a statute, we can take note of the self-evident design, and we can take note of how it is used, what it's designed to do. And when we look at...
I don't know that that's a pre-ambiguity canon, though.
My understanding is Retzlaff resolved it on the pre-ambiguity canon. I could double-check. I apologize if I'm incorrect, but I believe that's what they did.
I mean, because I thought that sort of the legislative intent, like the what was the intent of the law, sort of those broader concepts, I thought that those were the post-ambiguity, not the pre-ambiguity canons. But I'm willing to be corrected.
And I can check Retzlaff right now. My understanding is what they were talking about is not the inferred policy considerations behind what they did, but the I believe they use the phrase self-evident design. The words were express purpose,
Counsel,
the express function.
Do you agree that if we were to conclude the district court, post-conviction court, did not err in declining relief from the 2014 Stearns County conviction, we wouldn't even need to reach the statutory interpretation issue?
Your Honor, listening to Your Honor's comments during opposing counsel's oral argument, I'm not aware if the standard of interest, Your Honor is alluding to interest of justice exception, and whether there's a basis to get past that.
No, what I'm saying is, if this court were to, do you think we have to review in this appeal the 2014 post-conviction decision that Mr. Johannes was not entitled to challenge his conviction at that point in time, so it remains a felony conviction on his record?
I'll be perfectly honest, Your Honor. Looking at the district court's reasoning as in terms of whether to visit it, I mean, their main thing was the interest of justice exception does not apply because he's wrong in the merits anyways. I would concede that this is a case where, were it not for that juvenile adjudication, or were it not for treating that juvenile adjudication as a felony, there was no alternative path to make any subsequent DWI a felony. So I don't disagree with the argument that...
Okay, but what I'm asking you is, do you disagree? Are you here to argue in support of the post-conviction court's decision that the 2014 conviction challenge was untimely, therefore there would be no change to his record on the 2014 case?
I would agree that with the district court's decision that it was one, a post-conviction request, not a motion to correct.
That's what I'm asking.
And that it was past the 2 years.
And if we were to agree that the post-conviction court did not err, would there be reason to talk about the statutory language, adjudication versus conviction? As I look at this big picture, we need to first say the post-conviction court was wrong on the 2014 conviction. It should have been treated as a motion for sentencing correction. And then, quite frankly, I ask, if we were to go that way, would we then be saying, so we're remanding to the post-conviction court to get a decision on the merits? Or are we looking at that saying, well, we already have a decision on the merits from that case, so we just say up or down to that merits decision? And if the merits decision was correct, then the 2023 seems to be correct. If it was incorrect, it wasn't. I mean, what did the post-conviction court say in the on the 2014 case? This isn't a motion for sentence correction. It's a challenge to the conviction. It's untimely because it's more than whatever years passed, and I find that the interest of justice exception does not apply. Did the post-conviction court say, and even if it did, I would reject this argument that the juvenile offense was not appropriately used to enhance, here's why. Did the post-conviction court explain that reasoning as well?
I believe it did. In the order, it had said it first went with, this is a post-conviction request, not motion correct.
Okay.
And also, yes, I acknowledge, the court acknowledges that there can be an interest of justice exception, but it, from my recollection of the order, it had concluded that we don't believe there's any interest of justice in readdressing it because the merits behind the argument are wrong. The court agreed with the state's interpretation of the statute. That was the crux of the court's reasoning.
Thank you. So we do have a merits decision.
Correct. That's where the court's guidance leads us. And
in reviewing that merits decision, we would get to the issue of the statutory interpretation.
I would have to concede that, yes.
Excellent. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to, and I'm trying to remember where I left off, and I could certainly leave it open for questions if there were questions from my original.
And your merits argument, then, is even though the statute requires a felony conviction in two subparts, but in the first allows a prior impaired driving incident, which could include a juvenile adjudication.
Correct.
That a juvenile adjudication is somehow nonetheless a felony conviction for the purposes of the other two subparts?
No, my argument stems from the way the statute clarifies the meaning of the word conviction. It does, I agree with Judge Larson's point, they do use the phrase prior impaired driving conviction. It is a definition term. I believe that, however, we not only can look at where is it expressly used, but we can also look at what is the express function of it, and my argument is that the express function of it is to
was
the legislature.
Was the statute in Restorff one of the statutes that is like 0.01, the purpose of this statute is to do X, Y, Z, or are they saying in Restorff that we can sort of look at the broad legislative intent? Because, again, like one of those is a provision of the statute where
right.
It makes sense that you would look at that as part of the whole statute canon, as part of right that whole body of case law. But as soon as we're getting into the, like, fuzzy feelings, what was the legislature's purpose behind that, that all seems to be those tend to be the post-ambiguity canons.
Well, I think what's different is I would certainly agree. Let's say the legislature decided to make decided to include juvenile adjudications for enhanceable domestic assault offenses. And I were to come to say, well, if they believe that we should enhance those in that context, well, in the DUI context, we should do the same. I think that's a good example of getting away from the text and trying to just make an interpretation argument based on subjective policy considerations. What I think is different here is when we look at the qualified impaired driving definition and the whole reason it exists to clarify the meaning of conviction. And by having clarified the meaning of the word conviction, that could give guidance on the meaning of the word convicted. Because both
they put quotes around it, prior impaired driving conviction.
They do.
And then they proceed to use that precise phrase.
Correct.
Other places in the statute. It's not like they define it here and then they generally talk about convictions other places. They, in fact, use this defined term throughout the statute.
Right.
But they don't include it here.
Right.
And that's where I struggle with your argument. Why aren't the canons about we have to assume that when the legislature uses different language, it means different things? Why don't those sort of end the analysis here?
The reason I don't believe it ends the analysis, there's two, I would refer to the two cases, Retzlaff and Schmidt, and I'll start with Retzlaff. In Retzlaff, They were dealing with the same penalty. They were dealing with the felony DWI statute where they used the modifying language, so to speak, in that was the statute provisions for the specific offenses they wanted to make treat as felony enhanceable offenses. Like the way they described them was precisely by using their corresponding statute provisions. They failed to cite Retzlaff's provision. And the point the court made was, look, yes, we have to look at the plain text, and if a specific term is not used, that may be significant, but we don't take it to the extreme where that ends the analysis. They recognize that, look, the function, and this is where they talk about the self-evident design, the express purpose, is they want to make these offenses, these felony-level offenses, enhanceable. And that's the point I'm making about what they were doing with the word conviction in the qualified impaired driving conviction clause. The whole point of that in the juvenile language was to say, when we were referring to convictions that are enhanceable, when we say conviction, we're including juvenile adjudications. That's what it was all about, was giving meaning to the word conviction. So that's how I think Retzlaff helps us. And the other case would be Schmidt. In State v. Schmidt, that focused on the meaning of take. And in Schmidt, basically the court was confronted with, do we go with the statutory meaning of take or the common law? They did look at the statute, and there was a statutory definition for take that was expressly applied. Now, true, we don't have the express words qualified prior driving in subpart 1.3, but in Schmidt, what is significant is this. If it were true that this all came down to whether the magic words were spoken, if that were true in every analysis case, the Schmidt opinion would have ended right there and said we're done because this is all that matters. But then they went on to the presumption of consistent usage. They didn't just look at were the precise key terms used, but also how was the word used. And they illustrated situations where they had certain types of crimes that were punished based on taking deer while in a deer stand, taking deer while intoxicated, if I remember right.
Correct. And then, I mean, but the crux of that analysis is that take needed to mean something
right.
Different than the precise definition in order to give that phrase meaning throughout the same meaning throughout the statute. Here you're asking us, when the legislature used one word, to say that that had the same meaning as when they used multiple words, when the canons of construction would say that that difference matters. And I think that that's what makes it different than Schmidt, isn't it?
I believe depending on the context, it can matter. I mean, I'm not saying that is completely irrelevant. What I am saying is that it doesn't end the analysis. Is that even in a plain text analysis, we can take a look at what the apparent function is. And again, I'm not getting into, all right, let's look beyond the text and let's get into legislative history, because I agree we don't go there in the first analysis. But the central point, or the obvious function is to address the meaning of the word conviction. I mean, that's exactly what brought into play. And what we notice is that when we think of the term prior impaired driving conviction, I mean, it's a conviction for one of those offenses, and they took the very same offenses, the felony versions of those, in another enhancement provision clause where they both relate to enhancement. So it isn't as if we're trying to go into unrelated provisions that deal with different matters. We're dealing with two closely related provisions, and I believe the law allows us to do that, is let's see how it is used in related provisions. I mean, that's, in my opinion, what it means to look at the statute as a whole. I mean, so that would be my response to that point. I'll move on to the second analysis, unless the court has any further questions on the first analysis, because I understand the first one is dispositive. And I see I have 50 seconds. The one thing I would make a point about, or two points, is in the second analysis, legislative history, I would direct the court to 1989. Before that, they would just say prior conviction for a qualifying offense, where they directly said prior conviction is juvenile adjudication. The words impaired driving that were inserted in between them had nothing to do with a substantive change. What was happening, in my view, is that they were adding more crimes to the list of enhanceables. And rather than having to say previously been convicted of and stating those over and over, they came up with that phrase to save wording. So in my opinion, that had nothing to do with trying to change the substance of the meaning word conviction. It was just simply a new title to use for simplicity's sake. And in terms of the long-term punishment, last point, if I may, Mr. Scanlon made the comment that, you know, did the legislature really want to punish a juvenile for the rest of his life? This was not so much about long-term punishment, it's about long-term deterrence, because this is about safety. Drunk driving does claim lives, and I believe that that fits with the objective principles and the purposes of the statute. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two things to say about Retzlaff. Retzlaff is sui generis. It's on its own. I mean, the court said there, this is the unusual circumstance where the plain language results in an ends up with an absurd result. I mean, it basically was a scrivener's error. It was a drafting error in the statute. They left something out that obviously wasn't intended to be left out. And so it's hard to even tell whether are they pre-ambiguity or they post-ambiguity. It's just a unique case. I
also don't think that the Minnesota Supreme Court has ever used sort of general principles of legislative intent as a pre-ambiguity canon.
I think that's right. No, that's absolutely right. And I would point on the point about Retzlaff, though, I would, Judge Larson, what you were saying, Schwartz is exactly what you're talking about. That is actually, that's also a DWI case. That's the one where defendant was saying, well, there has to be a no or reason to know read into this particular version of DWI under 169A20. And what the court said was, well, we have a bunch of different definitions. In one of them, we use no or reason to know. And in the provision you're talking about, we didn't. And what Schwartz says is, and this is a 2021 Supreme Court case, the use of different language, we have to assume that's intentional. That's the deliberative process of the legislature. We have to assume that if they say this here and not there, they did so intentionally. If we get to legislative history or purpose, as I've argued in my briefs, 260B is all you need. That was enacted originally not as 260B in 1959. It has been the norm with regard to convictions as opposed to adjudications for that entire period. It remains, it continues. There are very good reasons why the legislature did that. And as I argued, all they're doing is leaving it to the discretion of the juvenile court. The juvenile court was within their power in 2011 to convict Mr. Johannes of a felony, a permanent adult felony conviction, EJJ or adult certification. By my reading, I don't know what the statutes were exactly at the time. I think he was actually probably a presumptive certification. I don't know why they didn't do it. But we can't do anything about that now. But again, my interpretation doesn't remove all juvenile impaired driving-related felonies from consideration ever. It's just up to the juvenile court to decide what's going to happen. And then as far as purpose, that whole decision, when you look at how the juvenile court decides whether they get certified, whether they get EJJ, as opposed to just doing a regular adjudication, it's all about public safety. It sets out all these different factors that you have to look at to decide whether public safety is going to be served sufficiently by an adjudication or whether there needs to be. And so that's all taken into account. The last thing, not to beat a dead horse, but I do think that as far as the interest of justice exception goes, I did cite in my case, there's a non-presidential opinion from this court where because it hadn't been addressed specifically in district court, this court remanded for the Stearns County District Court to address in the first instance whether the exception applies. I'm not saying that's what this court would have to do. I set out my argument fully. I don't think the respondent at any time and the district court didn't address the merits of the exception of the interest of justice exception.
The district court actually addressed the merits of the issue here, the statutory language.
I'm sorry?
If the post-conviction court considered and decided in the alternative the merits of the statutory language, isn't that part of our review?
Yes.
Okay, so then it's not all about procedure. It's like, well, the district court went to the merits, decided the merits against you, so we could consider the merits argument in the context of that post-conviction decision, as well as in the context of the sentencing decision in the 2023 case, and just get to the merits.
I think that's
regardless
right. I think that's right.
Time limit or interest of justice exception.
Yeah, I mean, in all candor, honestly, as I stand here, if you reach the merits for the 2013 case, that the decision about it not about it being time barred still has to be addressed, because we still need to decide whether are we amending the 2014 sentence or aren't we? Because even if this court disagrees on the merits, the Stearns County District Court has said no. Even if you agree on the merits, you don't get to reach it. I'm saying that you lose on the merits, and so I'm not applying it. I mean, technically. I mean, I guess she didn't specifically address, do a full, like, explication.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So if we were to say the judge was wrong on the merits, we still have to decide whether or not, because it was an alternative ruling.
Whether or not this court can order the 2014 sentence to be amended.
Understood. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for the vigorous argument and helping the court to understand the important issues in the case. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the court's oral calendar this morning. Thank you. Good to see you.
All rise.